Well, I'd like to say what a pleasure it is to be here again. Really been looking forward to this. If you were coming here and you registered and planned, made your plans thinking that Brother Hamilton was going to be here, I'm sorry you can't get your money back. So I was delighted to be able to pinch hit for him tonight. I really don't mind being playing second fiddle. I got a good dose of that early on when Hope and I were students at Florida College. She came there with the notion that she was not going to date just one person. And so she was actually dating two of us for a while. And the other fella and I were in competition at the end of my second year for Mr. Florida College. He edged me out. He got the title Mr. Florida College. I came in second. But what I've always said is he got the title, but I got the prize because Hope married me, not him. So second fiddle isn't all that bad. I'm just tickled, delighted to be here tonight to talk to you. I'm a little bit intimidated for a couple of reasons. One, I don't normally speak to this many people because in the bilingual work with dozens of other congregations in the Tampa area, we typically have smaller crowds than this. Another reason I'm intimidated is because there are people here who know a lot more about my subject tonight than I do. But you're not up here, so we'll go with what we've got. A third thing is that I'm used to preaching in English and Spanish. I'll say a few words in one language and then I'll just switch to the other. And I've been doing it long enough that it's just sort of automatic. I don't even think about it. So if I happen to start speaking in Spanish tonight, if a few of those palabras come out of my mouth, Stephen, you just hold your hand up, say, hold it, Brother Royce, get your mind in gear, and we'll go from there. I'm really delighted. I look forward to the whole time together. Is this thing ready to go? Okay. I want to show you a picture of a guy who decided, sort of like me, when I first took on do-it-yourself projects, many years ago. This fella had a problem not unlike some of the ones I used to have. And so I just asked a simple question. What was he thinking? Or this guy? Maybe he doesn't read English. I don't know what the problem there was, but what was he thinking? Trying to drive that thing, which obviously was so much taller than the entranceway into that underpass there. Or this guy. What was he thinking? Yeah, I don't know. I hope he survived. For those of you from Texas, I had to throw something in. What in the world was he thinking? Or what about this guy? Does that look like your dentist? What was he thinking? Man, I don't think I would want to go to that guy. But, you know, there's a point to all of that. It is that some people simply have to learn things the hard way. I've been there lots of times. Probably a good many of you have too. I'd rather not learn things the hard way. I really prefer the easy way, if there's a way to do that. But sometimes that just doesn't work out too well. And that's the problem that a lot of people have with God's Word. The problem some folks have with believing that God really means it when he says, look, this is my word, it's perfect, it's complete, just like it is, don't mess with it. Well, that sounds simple enough when we read some of those verses where God tells us that kind of a thing, but when it comes to putting that into practice, sometimes we get ourselves into some strange predicaments. And so if we can avoid learning spiritual lessons the hard way, how much easier life might be. So I want to look at a few examples of people that you will know from the scriptures, but some people who apparently just insisted on learning things the hard way. And if we can learn from them, then maybe our lives and our relationship with God will have less problems attached to it. So I want to start with Moses. Familiar story in Numbers chapter 20. We're going to be doing quite a bit of reading here. I'll try not to read too fast, but if you want to read along in whatever translation you're using, that's fine. I'll be putting the text up here on the screen. I'm calling him Angry Moses. because that's what he was at this particular time. But first of all, let's read this passage from Deuteronomy 4 and a verse from Deuteronomy 5. When God said something and made it pretty clear, "Hear now, O Israel, the decrees and laws I am about to teach you. Follow them so that you may live and may go in and take possession of the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, is giving you. Do not add what I command you, and do not subtract from it." Pretty clear, right? We all agree that's pretty plain English. "But keep the commands of the Lord your God that I give you. So be careful to do what the Lord your God has commanded you. Do not turn aside to the right or to the left." That's really clear. So if we come away from that when Moses reads it to the people, everybody at that time could say, "Oh, okay, I understand that." But it's the times of provocation when things are not quite as easy, when we're just sitting there listening to Moses read that, that it tests or proves whether or not we're really going to listen and obey those kinds of commandments. So we go to Numbers 20, and the problem is, of course, that there was no water. The people were getting in a rather sour kind of a mood. They gathered in opposition to Moses and Aaron. They quarreled with Moses and said, "If only we had died when our brothers fell dead before the Lord. Why did you bring the Lord's community into this desert that we and our livestock should die here? Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to this terrible place? It has no grain or figs, grapevines, pomegranates, and there's no water to drink." Moses and Aaron went to the tent of meeting, fell face down, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to that rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. You will bring water out of the rock for the community so that they and their livestock can drink." Problem solved, it seems. So Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock, and Moses said to them, "Listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock?" Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock twice with his staff. Water gushed out, and the community and their livestock drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not trust in me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land I gave them." Now we know that story, and we know it pretty well. And to some degree, we can understand Moses' state of mind. When he gets everybody together after the Lord has told him what to do, what kind of a mindset do you think he has when he says, "Listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock?" You think he said that in an angry fashion or in a very calm, laid-back kind of a fashion? "Listen, you rebels, shall we bring you water out of this rock?" I doubt that. What's the primary problem with what he said? Is it that he was angry? Did God get on to him for being angry? No. What did God punish him for? He said, "You didn't believe in me enough to honor me before this assembly." Well, who did he honor? He honored himself and Aaron. Shall we bring forth water instead of shall God, or stand back and watch what God is going to do? Well, we know that story. So here's our modern day reporter. We'll just call him Bill O'Reilly. He pops up and says, Moses, just a minute. I got to ask the hard question. Why did you do it?" And if Moses is on the Bill O'Reilly show, what answer is he going to give? He says, "Go ahead, Moses, tell us the facts. Why did you do what you did?" Well, I think we all know pretty well what he would say and about how he would say it. Say, "Listen, the truth is, I was so angry." And maybe he would finish that off with something like, "I just wasn't thinking. I didn't think straight. It just slipped out before I could catch myself," or something like that. But whatever else might come onto it, it's obvious from what reading we have, he was so angry he didn't give proper attention to what he was supposed to be doing in terms of honoring God instead of himself. So here are the consequences. At that time, I pleaded with the Lord. O sovereign Lord, you have begun to show to your servant your greatness and your strong hand. For what God is there in heaven or on earth who can do the deeds and mighty works you do? Let me go over and see the good land beyond the Jordan, that fine hill country in Lebanon. But because of you, the Lord was angry with me and would not listen to me. In fact, what did God say to him? Not unlike what I heard from my mom and dad on occasion when I was growing up. That's enough. Don't bring it up again. Do not speak to me anymore about this matter. Go to the top of Pisgah and look in all these directions. Look at the land with your own eyes, since you are not going to cross this Jordan. Wow. And we know that part of the story too. Heavy punishment. Severe. It's tempting to think maybe over severe, but who in the world are we to judge that? There may have been a lot more to it than just you've got to have some punishment that matches the sin. There may have been other considerations that maybe we can talk about some other time. Well, we know what happened with angry Moses. So let's go to these two men. Nadab and Abihu, you know who was their dad? Aaron, the high priest, and of course his two sons here are helping him with the sacrifices. I'm calling them blind Nadab and Abihu, not because they were physically so, but obviously something happened inside their heart, and their head, at a critical moment. Let's read from Leviticus 10. Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, took their censers, put fire in them, and added incense, and they offered unauthorized fire, some of your translations say strange fire, before the Lord, contrary to his command. Well, the command was, when you're going to burn incense, you take fire from the altar, and you use that fire to burn the incense. Well, obviously, they didn't get their fire there. They got it somewhere else. And so verse 1 calls it strange fire or unauthorized fire. Well, what was the consequence of that? Oh, I'm so sorry. Just wasn't thinking. No, the response of God was pretty much immediate. Fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them. And they died before the Lord. Moses then said to Aaron, "This is what the Lord spoke of. When he said, among those who approach me, I will show myself holy. In the sight of all the people, I will be honored." Well, obviously, they committed the same sin Moses had committed. They failed to honor the Lord. Took things upon themselves to... Well, you know the story. And so they were punished. Burned up. Swift, severe. Does that give us some idea of how important it is to the Lord that he be honored, that he be glorified, and that we avoid at all costs honoring and glorifying ourselves when it's God who needs to be honored and glorified? It's a terrible story, but if you and I can learn, they learned it the hard way. Hopefully you and I don't have to do that. Well, if he had a chance, Mr. O'Reilly would say, "Why did you do it? Tell us. Everybody wants to know. Tell us just the facts. Why in the world did you offer that strange fire?" And maybe they could say a lot of things, but somewhere in that it might come out to mean something like this. We just didn't see any difference between fire taken from before the altar or fire taken from a campfire or fire taken from someplace else. Fire is fire. The important thing is burning the incense. Who cares where the fire comes from? Well, we know the answer to that one, don't we? God cared. Which is why he had been specific. When he said, "You use that fire to burn the incense." So another lesson learned the hard way. King Saul is always a good one to use. Well, I should say he's a bad one to use for this kind of example. Pardon. In 1 Samuel 13, the Philistines were assembled together to fight Israel. They had 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore. Okay, that sounds pretty bad. Even worse when we consider how many chariots did the Israelites have? How about zero? And you've got the modern war machine out there, 3,000 of those war machines, 6,000 men to run them through your camp and create all kinds of damage and havoc. But that's not the worst of it. The soldiers couldn't even count them. There were so many. They went up and camped at Michmash, east of Beth-Aven. When the men of Israel saw their situation, it was critical. Their army was hard-pressed. They hid. Where's the caves? Let's go find the caves, the thickets, any place we can find, among the rocks and cisterns and pits. Some even crossed the Jordan over to the land of Gad and Gilead. Saul stayed at Gilgal, and all the troops were with him, quaking with fear. He waited 7 days, the time set by Samuel, but Samuel didn't come to Gilgal, and Saul's men began to scatter. So he said, "Bring me the burnt offering and the fellowship offerings." And he offered them just as he finished. Samuel arrived, and Saul went out to greet him. "What have you done?" asked Samuel. Saul replied, "When I saw that the men were scattering, that you didn't come at the set time, that the Philistines were assembling, I thought, now they're going to come down to Gilgal, and I haven't sought the Lord's favor. So I felt compelled to offer the burnt offering." Well, if there's a situation that seems to be something that would press a king to make an executive decision because of the dire circumstance, that would be that kind of a situation. But even after that kind of reaming out of the prophet Samuel, "It's your fault, Samuel." Well, how did Samuel respond to that? You remember? He said, "You acted foolishly." And that line was there a long time before Indiana Jones. "You acted foolishly. You chose foolishly. You have not kept the command the Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now, your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him leader of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command." What was it? What was the command? "Wait 7 days until Samuel comes." Because Samuel was the one who had to offer the sacrifices. You didn't keep the command. So he was rejected. "Your lineage would continue, but not now. You're the last one of your line to sit on the throne." Well, if Mr. Bill got a chance to ask him, "Saul, tell us, why in the world did you do that? You knew the commandment." However he would phrase it, it had to come out something like this. "It was an emergency situation. Somebody had to act. I'm the king. I thought maybe God was testing me to see if I had what it takes to be king, to make those kind of decisions. There's never been a king before, so I had to do something. Everybody was looking to me because the prophet wasn't here. And in such an emergency, I acted." Sounds reasonable. That would probably get by me. Which is one of many reasons I wasn't Samuel. But he was rejected. Now, occasion number two. Samuel said to Saul, "Go attack the Amalekites. Totally destroy everything. Don't spare anything. Men, women, children, infants, cattle, sheep, camels, donkeys. Don't spare anything." So Saul attacked the Amalekites. He took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive, and all his people he totally destroyed with the sword. But Saul and the army spared Agag and the best of the sheep and cattle, the fat calves and lambs, everything that was good. These they were unwilling to destroy completely, because but everything that was despised and weak, they totally destroyed. Then the word of the Lord came to Samuel, I am grieved that I have made Saul king, because he has turned away from me and has not carried out my instructions. Now the flaw in Saul's actions there are really easy to see, right? Because God was so clear, you go and attack that people, it's time for that race, at least this part of that race, to disappear from the earth. Don't spare any human being. Don't spare any animal. Is that clear? Yes, it's clear. All right, go. So how do you get from receiving a commandment that's that clear to it, when it's about over? Well, keep him alive, send some soldiers through, and save the best of the animals. Do you imagine there was more than a few standing around saying, what? What did Saul say to do? You think anybody went and argued with him? Said, Saul, we heard what Samuel said. Well, if they did, we're not privileged to any of those conversations. But we do know this. Samuel was troubled, and he cried out to the Lord all that night. When Samuel reached him, Saul said, the Lord bless you. I have carried out the Lord's instructions. And I know every time one of us preachers touches on that text, we all have to make a big deal out of that. Because it is a big deal. What in the world was Saul thinking when he said that? Samuel said, then what is this bleating of the sheep in my ears? And what's the lowing of cattle that I hear? Well, the soldiers brought them from the Amalekites. They spared the best to sacrifice to the Lord your God. What's wrong with that statement? Well, a couple of things. The soldiers decided, really? You think they just took it upon themselves to defy the order they knew the king was under? Oh, King Saul won't mind. The prophet won't mind. Now, the soldiers did what they were instructed to do. No, it's the soldiers who did it, but look at why they did it. They spared them not to go home and have a great feast. They spared them to offer to not our God, not my God, but to your God. Is that some kind of confession of where Saul was in his relationship with God? I went on the mission the Lord assigned me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites and brought back Agag, their king. Say that again. I completely destroyed them and brought Agag back alive. Say that again. Don't you see the contradiction in that sentence? The soldiers took sheep and cattle from the plunder, the best of what was devoted to God, in order to sacrifice them to the Lord your God at Gilgal. And since this is the second occasion like this, maybe it's not so strange that Saul is saying these things that seem to make absolutely no sense, that anyone could understand the contradictions in what he's saying. But he's already been through the first incident. He's been rejected by God so far as his lineage is concerned, and now he's just further down the hill from any good relationship with God, and he's just saying nonsense here. Why did you not obey the Lord? Why did you pounce on the plunder and do evil in the eyes of the Lord? Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than a sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. Rebellion is like the sin of divination or witchcraft, and arrogance like the evil of idolatry. So what sins did God charge King Saul with here? Rebellion and arrogance. And whatever other word might account for his saying, I've killed everybody, but I brought Agag back alive. I've done everything you told me to do, but we've got all this plunder. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king. You have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you as king over Israel. The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to one of your neighbors, to one better than you. Hard words to hear. So many times I've wished that King Saul had learned the first time, but apparently he did not. And so the second case seems to be even worse in some ways than the first, because he so repeatedly condemns himself with his own words as he tries to explain that he has obeyed when he's done nothing but arrogantly rebel. And so the consequence, I've torn the kingdom from you today and given it to a better man. Hard words to hear, no doubt. Well, King Saul, why? Why in the world did you do it? The other time you said it was an emergency, but apparently you didn't really listen or learn from that. No emergency this time. So why did you do it? Why, don't you know? Did it for God. Well, there you go. That's the reason that covers all sins, right? I can do anything I want if I'm doing it for God, and it doesn't really matter. But no, but wait, the Bible says, oh, it doesn't matter. As long as I'm doing it for God, He'll understand. You sure about that? We're doing this for God. Look at all these animals. We're going to have a great, gigantic sacrifice to honor the Lord. Well, what did God say about that? What honors me is obedience. It's not this ritual. It's not sacrifice. Obedience is what honors me. Well, let's look at Upsaza. One of those strange stories. We don't know a lot of detail about this as much as we do, for example, about King Saul. But in 1 Chronicles 13, let's bring the ark of our God back to us. For we did not inquire of it during the reign of Saul. The whole assembly agreed to do this because it seemed right to all the people. They moved the ark of God from Abinadab's house on a new cart with Uzzah and Ahio guiding it. When they came to the threshing floor of Kidon, Uzzah reached out his hand to steady the ark because the oxen stumbled. Okay, so what's wrong with that? Because it's obvious by now, if I've just read that passage, I'm going to find something wrong with what he did, right? So what's the matter with that? Sounds like a perfectly good idea. Ark's been gone for a long time. It's been taken by the Philistines. They sent it back because of all kinds of problems. And it stayed in Abinadab's house here for a good while, and now let's bring it home. Great idea. Everybody agreed to that. Now, who's the king now? Saul's dead, right? David's the king. All the people say, okay, let's bring it home. So, all right, here's a new cart. Put it on the cart. Keep it nice and safe. And as they're going, oxen stumbles and the ark tilts. And Uzzah reaches up to keep the holy ark of God from falling and shattering on the ground. Sounds like a heroic gesture. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah, and he struck him down because he put his hand on the ark. So he died there before God. Well, we know why he wasn't supposed to touch the ark, right? Because God had forbidden any man to touch the ark. So why was the ark in a position to be touched? Because something else was wrong with this story. How were they supposed to transport the ark? Had little rings on the side, and they put long staves through the rings, and they were carried by the Levites so that no man touched the ark. And when you're carrying it by these wooden poles on both sides, you've got really secure control over it. Well, no, that's the way they used to do it, but now we've got a modern transportation system. Let's put it in the cart, strong oxes, and sure enough, suddenly the ark is vulnerable to being broken apart because the original commandment is not being followed. They're not transporting it the right way. And so Uzzah, in one flash of a moment, probably didn't have time to think. All he saw was the ark was in danger of falling, and he just, by instinct, just stuck that hand up to keep the ark from shattering. I might have done exactly the same thing. You might have done that. I would just hope If I'd been back there, then I was nowhere near the ark, just in case. But Uzzah was the unlucky fellow. And we see what God did to him. Why did you do that, Uzzah? Why did you touch the ark when everyone in Israel knows that's forbidden? No man touches that ark. Why did you do it? Well, what do you mean? I thought, what'll happen if I don't? I mean, can you imagine the Ark of the Covenant shattering on the ground? Can you imagine letting that happen? Well, no, not really. I can't. That would be a horrible thing. So I just reacted. What's going to happen if I don't? Well, a better question would be, what'll happen if I do? And he found out the hard way. That when God says something, that's what God means. And do you remember that passage we read in Deuteronomy 4? And that was stressed again in Deuteronomy 5? These are my commandments. These are my statutes. You take them just as they are. Don't add anything to them. Don't take anything away from them. Don't go to the right. Don't go to the left. Take them and do them exactly. That worked for Moses. That worked for Nadab and Abihu. That worked for King Saul. It worked for Uzzah. God is honored by obedience, not by excuses we make up or that we fabricate because we think that it's okay to do something different than what God has commanded. So what do we learn? Let's summarize our lesson and then we'll take a break. Probably more things than I'm going to list here, but a few very important lessons from looking at these men who learned things the hard way. One obvious lesson is that disobedience never turns out right. Doesn't matter the reason. Doesn't matter the excuse. Disobedience does not turn out right. There's no good consequence from disobeying God. We must do it God's way or else. That's what God has said over and over. He's not only said it, he's illustrated it over and over. And we've seen these several illustrations tonight. If Moses didn't get by with it, how in the world could Royce Chandler get by with it? Can't do it. Another important lesson is the end does not justify the means. The end is to preserve the ark. What are the means? Touching it. Better let the ark be shattered on the ground than disobey God. Human thinking, responding to a fabricated emergency situation that shouldn't have been there in the first place, and in doing so, disobeys the direct command of God. Can't do that. Each person is accountable. Sometimes, you know, we may be tempted to think, well, I have a special situation, maybe in people to whom I'm related, because he or she or they are so godly that I can sort of, you know, ride in on their reputation or on their godliness. If Moses was held accountable, are you not going to be held accountable? I can't imagine saying to God, if I had the chance, No. Don't, you can't, I mean, please don't hold me accountable on this. You know, it is a mistake. I wasn't thinking. It was an emergency. Whatever I can think of to say. I know Moses didn't get by with it, but I'm hoping you'll let me get by with it. Does that sound just a little bit arrogant? I think so. But sometimes we might be tempted. Oh, I'm married to the most godly person in the world. And I can sort of bask in the holiness of that other person. Or my parents or my relation, this person, these people, they're just so godly. And as long as I'm with them, it's just sort of like, have you ever... I shouldn't tell this. But when I was a kid, there's a theater block and a half from my house. And I worked there for a while. But it was a common thing that if, you know, five or six high school kids go up and four of them pay for tickets, and one of them just sort of hides in the middle and walks in with the rest of them. Sometimes they get away with that. Or at the drive-in theater, hide someone in the trunk. And pay and go, and they just thought that was a great thing. And that was even before Adam's days of hiding in car trunks. But sometimes we sort of have that mentality that maybe we can just sort of go in because of the people we associate with. It's just not so. Moses could not get by with it. King Saul could not get by with it. These holy men of God, even priests, could not get by with it. When God has revealed his will on the matter, that's his will. And we must do exactly what he said, or there are consequences that will be suffered. And if we can look at these men and see time after time after time after time, the story was always the same. Disobedience brings consequences. It doesn't matter the excuse for the disobedience. Be it, I was just so upset. I was just so angry. It was such an emergency. What'll happen if I don't? I didn't see any difference between this and that. When God has expressed his will, that's his will. Now, whose obligation is it to know what his will is? It's my obligation, and it's your obligation, because he's revealed it to us in his word. Am I going to be able to go to the judgment and say, well, you know, I just never did read that much. I didn't pay all that much attention to it, really. I didn't think it mattered. Does that sound like Nadab and Abihu? Didn't think it mattered. What do we learn? Don't try to improve on what God has said. It just won't work. Some people have to learn things the hard way. And there are enough examples in the Bible to teach us that repeatedly. If we can remember those examples, and if we can remember these simple but very important lessons, maybe we can avoid the tragedy of having to pay consequences because we just didn't pay enough attention or didn't care enough to know exactly what the will of God was. And so we just decided, well, it probably won't make all that much difference anyway if we accept the common attitude that's out there in our generation. The only thing that really matters is what's in your heart. Do you love God? I read some comment. Any of you watch American Pickers? You know what that is? Anybody know American Pickers? Okay, several. All right. I don't feel like such a strange duck then. But there's a colorful-looking lady that works in the office for the two guys who travel all over the country picking people's junk. Then they refurbish it or resell it for a profit. And this lady had a quote somewhere on the internet basically stating her approval of homosexuality. And her justification for that said something like this, well, you know, if you love God, that's all that matters. Nothing else matters beyond that. I would like for you to take these examples we've looked at tonight and see if that flies in any one of them. Did Moses love God? Oh, yeah. Did Nadab and Abihu love God? As far as we know. Did King Saul? Well, at least early in his life, he did. But no, it only matters what's in your heart. If you really love God, nothing else matters. I mean, there couldn't be anything more different from what the Bible actually teaches. Obedience, God said, is what honors me. Not excuses, not feelings, not emotions. Obedience is what honors me, and I will be honored, he said. That's it. Thank you for your attention. Let's take a short break, and then we'll go with what happens after that. Okay, welcome back. Got a few questions here. This is not so much a question as it is an explanation talking about the wrong way they transported the ark in the cart instead of with the poles through the rings on the side. The question is, what did David do to resolve the situation after Uzzah was killed? And then the person wrote the answer. 1 Chronicles 15, David called everybody together. He said, now you priests, you get yourselves in order. You do your job like you're supposed to do. And you carry the ark the way it's supposed to be carried, because that's why God broke out against us, because we didn't follow his pattern. So First Chronicles 15, if you want to read that resolution. Don't know if this question has a definite answer, but what do you think was the eternal consequence? What do you think was the eternal consequence of Uzzah's touching the ark? Well, I deal with that the way I deal with the eternal consequence that relates to every one of us. I leave that up to God. That's not my job to decide eternal consequences. I know what God tells us in the scripture, and I know what my obligations are. If God chooses to show mercy where I think he probably won't or shouldn't, that's not my decision to make. And so eternal consequences, I'll just say, ask God when you get there. And personally, I hope eternally he's merciful to Uzzah. Because if he's merciful to Uzzah, that gives me a better chance. So we shall perhaps see. Do you think if Uzzah let the ark fall that God would have saved the ark? I don't have a clue. There's no way to know, right? It might have been, you could go either way with guessing, you know, would it have been good for God to save it miraculously, or would it have been good for God to let it shatter? Well, you could think of good reasons why either one of those might have happened. But since the Bible doesn't tell us, with pretty much everything that I've ever been asked that the Bible isn't clear on, I just say, I don't know. Those are the three magic words, right? I don't know. Because the Bible doesn't say. And if God doesn't say, there's no point in me trying to say. Okay, interesting questions here. You said in your lesson that disobeying God never turns out right. Was Rahab held accountable for disobeying by lying? Or even modern day examples, what about people hiding Jews during World War II and lying about it? Can disobedience bring about good? Another example in the American Revolution where they disobeyed the God-ordained government. Loaded questions, really good questions. And to some degree, I have to say, I don't know the exact answer to that. Lying is lying. Can God use bad people to do good things? Yeah, he did that all the time. God used one of the worst people ever, by reputation at least, Judas. But did Judas's disobedience, his rebellion, his being a traitor, was that okay? No, the sin was not okay. Did God use the sin to bring about good? Yeah, because God has that power. He can take even our sins and our rebellion and our disobedience and cause some good to come from it. That doesn't mean that therefore because some good comes from it, I'm going to be saved. It just means that God can work things out the way he wants things to be worked out. And I don't pretend to know how he handles some of those situations. Did he excuse Rahab's lying? Does the text tell us? No. It doesn't even mention it. Did things turn out okay for Rahab? In many respects, yeah, they really did. Because we know she became a convert to Judaism. And apparently her faithfulness was to such a degree that she became a part of the lineage of Jesus himself. So what happened? Did somebody talk to her about her lying? I don't know. Did God just overlook it? The Bible doesn't say. What about people in the American Revolution who defied the government? Well, you know, I've read all kinds of arguments through the years by, at the time, preachers of renown, all of them arguing one side and also the other side. That there comes a time when we must obey God rather than man, and the view of some of them was that to obey God meant that they had to fight on one side, and to others, to obey God meant that they had to fight on the other side. Now, who is it that's going to decide who obeyed and who disobeyed? I'm going to leave that up to God. That's his call. It's not mine. That doesn't mean if I made the wrong call that God just overlooks my disobedience. I'll have to answer for that one way or the other. Can my disobedience turn out to somebody else's good? Yeah, it can. The people who hid the Jews and lied about it, what would you have done, do you think? If you had a family of Jews in your basement or in your attic and the Nazis came and you knew they were going to slaughter them, what would you have done? Well, to me, the easy answer used to be, well, I'm not going to fib. I'd just give them up. I'd let them go be slaughtered. But it's not quite that simple to answer when you're in the situation, is it? I do an awful lot of praying, and I'd ask for wisdom, and I would really hope that the decision I came to would be the one that most honored God. And does it come down to either lying and giving them up to the slaughter, or I mean, not lying and giving up to the slaughter, or lying and saving their lives and honoring the value that God placed on their lives? That can be a really tough question. And it'll be debated, you know, as long as people continue to face those kinds of situations. So I'm not trying to waffle out of giving an answer. There are some things the Bible just doesn't give us a clear answer to. I mean, it states stories, and then have you ever, for example, doesn't deal with what we did talked about tonight. But I was teaching a class last Wednesday on that dealt with the opening chapters in Genesis. And if there's anything ever in the history of this universe that we would want a lot of information on, the only information we have is, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Period. Okay, a few details. On day one, these things. Day two, these things. Down through day six, these things. But you put all the information we have on the creation of this universe and the creation of the world, the unbelievable creative genius behind all of that, and all we have are just a couple of little paragraphs of explanation. Why in the world didn't God tell us more? Well, I don't know. And why does he say, or why does he use evil people to bring about good things? Well, because he can. Do you remember how I described the Assyrian Empire in Isaiah 10? There was hardly ever a more wicked, brutal group of people than the Assyrian army. Just for fun, they would impale people on stakes, peel the skin off of them while they were still alive. And I can't think of worse brutalities than those committed by the Assyrian armies. But did God approve any of that? Don't think so. But do you remember what he called Assyria in Isaiah chapter 10? When he said, I'm going to bring Assyria down, and Assyria is going to destroy Israel. He called Assyria, he used the word that we translate deacon. My deacon, my servant. Calling him my deacon and my servant didn't justify anything. It didn't make it good. It didn't make it okay. It just indicated that here's a horrible group of people that God could use to an end that suited his will. Then when his will was accomplished, he did away with those people. I appreciate those questions. They're really tough questions. If you find the definitive answer to those, please email me. I would like to know them. Sometimes it's really tough to know. I think that's it. Thank you.